This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
This episode of Kennedy Saves the World. We're back to Kennedy's book club, and only Brett Baer and Brian Kilmeade have been back for two firsts and sometimes three firsts. Well, you might have to sit yourself down for this one because we're going to talk about a book that if you don't read it closely enough, and certainly if you don't make it to the end, it could seem a little negative. It could seem like it has a dim view of the universe and whatever we are, and how we evolved and come to be. Joining me once again, he is the co-author of this book, Chris Ferry, who, of course, is an associate professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia. Chris, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, it's great to be back.
I think it should be great for you to be back because I really enjoyed reading this book, and I was going to skip ahead to a few chapters, and then it was very funny because I found myself still digging in because the chapters are so scintillatingly named that you kind of can't stop once you get to a new header. So, for example, you get to, you know, you finish up invisible rays or melting our genetic code. And then, you know, you come upon a chapter that says bad things taste good. And I was like, holy hell, what does that mean? And, you know, the way you frame it, the conclusion isn't entirely surprising, but the descriptions are fantastic. You even have a chapter called Sex Sucks, and you go into great detail about pointy and painful cat penises. Can you explain how cat penises might be a metaphor for a difficult universe as a whole?
Well, yeah, I guess You can go back a little bit further to life and evolution and see that evolution isn't it's not a friendly process, right? I mean, we're fighting for survival, and you can see life itself as something that is difficult, and that's somehow the way it's meant to be. The universe, if you think it's it caused this. It set up the laws. So it, if you want to personify it, it wants this, right? So it wants all of these terrible things like, barbed cat penises and things like that.
Which make intercourse very painful for female cats. I'm not a fan of cats, but I felt a great deal of sympathy for the female of the species once I read that chapter of the book. There's so much interesting and fascinating tidbits. There's so much rich material and so many F-bombs. How do you decide when to swear and when to go full technicolor technical?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's something you just develop a feeling for, I guess, when you're writing about this stuff.
But you have two co-authors. So there's a lot of cursing in the book that I interviewed you about not long ago, Quantum Bullshit. So they'll bleep part of that word. But you have two co-authors here, Wade David Fairclough and Bern Lagonestra. What?
Yeah. They're Australian high school science teachers, and they had a podcast, and we met many years ago, and it's kind of a crude science podcast, science comedy podcast, and we hit it off, and they kind of have the same sense of humor as me, and it worked really well. I think we kind of wrote our own chapters, and then we got together and edited each other's chapters, and I can't remember if mine had more swearing in them or not, but we had to kind of normalize and the amount of swearing across the book. So it seemed like there was one voice, one author.
There was one voice. And I was very impressed by that because as I was reading it, I was trying to figure out, you know, I've never talked to Wade. I've never talked to Byrne, but I was trying to figure out who wrote what. And it's very seamless. Like you can definitely hear someone's voice explaining these things to you and, you know, using the metaphors and illustrations in a very clever way that keeps you captivated while also making you laugh, which is not easy to do when you're getting across some pretty heavy information about how inhospitable the universe really is. But given that, and given all the ways that we could die, whether it's space travel or nanobots or viruses, there is something comforting knowing that even with all of that going on, and it's so deadly and it's so dead set against us, we're still here.
Yeah, that's right. So the subtitle of the book is "And One Reason Not to Hate the Universe," or "And One Reason Not to."
And I'm not going to spoil the ending, and I'll let you do that if you want to, because I want people to make it to the end of the book.
Right. Well, we definitely don't recommend binge reading it to get to the end, because that can be a bit existentially terrifying. But I won't give away exactly what we wrote in the end, but it's basically the idea that, you know, we're not external to the universe. Like, the universe isn't a possible place that we have a choice to go as if there's somewhere else to go. We are a part of the universe. Everything in the world around you, outside of the world around you, internal to you, it's all just atoms in different patterns. So the things that you see, all that terrifying stuff, is the same thing that is making you. You are a part of the universe. So you can't hate yourself. I mean, you're the hero of your own story. So you have to feel like you're a part of this universe. And if you want to personify it and say it's a terrible person, you should hate it, then maybe that's empowering. You're the hero. It's the villain, and your job is to win.
We're all fighting for something. Even though you wrote on page 25, most life is as useless as a knitted condom. Explain.
Well, I think the usefulness of a knitted condom should be self-explanatory.
I know, but it's such a great visual because I just think of a grandma somewhere sitting and doing a little crochet in front of The Price is Right. You know, thinking to herself, well, I really don't like this Drew Carey as much as Bob Barker, but I sure want my grandson Niles to be safe at college, so I'm going to go ahead and knit him a few condoms.
I'm sure you could find them online.
All right, you start talking. I'll look right now.
Yeah. You could find knitted anything. Well, yeah, there's various internet rules where it tells you can basically find anything out there.
I had an old lady in Ukraine needlepoint on a pillow for my friend Kat after we went to South Africa. Malaria is like herpes. Once you get it, you got it, because that's what one of our safari goers said. And we laughed so hard about that for days, and I felt like it had to be immortalized. And yes, there was in fact an older lady in Ukraine who, you know, was just a whiz at needlepoint. And about 2 weeks later, that pillow showed up.
Life is as useless as a knitted condom.
Rainbow Condom Crochet on Etsy. On Ravelry, there's a condom pattern for a knitted condom. And Tumblr has what looks like it's a condom scrotum sock combo. So it's a little scrote cozy. So I think that's pretty miraculous that human beings can think of enough about themselves that they can knit scrote sacks.
How can you hate the universe in the end when something like that exists?
Well, what I didn't know, like some of the numbers that you provide in the book are staggering. Like our galaxy has 300 million habitable planets.
That's kind of what we reckon, yeah, an estimate, yeah, yeah.
How do you get that estimate? And that seems like a lot for one galaxy.
Well, there's, you know, hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy. And when we look at those stars, we can see planets around them, right? And we know kind of, we know pretty much enough about the star to say, you know, how hot is it? So how, if you're a certain distance away and you're on a rocky planet, you know, what temperature would it be? Could there be liquid water? So that's kind of, we look at a bunch of stars and we see, okay, how many planets around those stars would be within a zone, a region where there could be liquid water. And based on the number we find for the stars that we look at, we just extrapolate and then make a guess. I mean, most stars that we look at have planets around them. Like there's a lot of planets. So if you just kind of multiply the numbers together, you out pops an estimate. I mean, it's a really rough estimate, but it's not zero. It's definitely not zero. It's a lot.
That's more than zero. It's a lot more than zero. A lot higher than most people can count. All right, we got more of this interview after this.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
In the book, you're like, Mars is really inhospitable. The 7 minutes of terror. I mean, it sounds like something that you'd ride at Six Flags. And that's entering the Martian atmosphere.
Yeah, today it's not terror for any of the robots that we sent there, but it's terror for the people sitting at NASA headquarters or flight command, because they have no contact. They know that the robot or the lander or whatever it is entering the Martian atmosphere, but it's 7 minutes away by the speed of light. So we're talking right now. There's a slight delay. It's maybe 100 to 200 milliseconds, right? And that's because you're on the other side of the world and light has to travel through fiber optic cables to get to you. And then my voice gets decoded. But Mars isn't on the other side of the world. It's 7 light minutes away.
Wow.
Right? So we won't be able to communicate with people living on Mars in the way that we communicate with people here. It'd be, you know, it's every message is a 7 minute delay. So it'd be going back to,
that is so annoying.
Yeah.
What do we have to solve to text people on Mars faster? Because that, you would think your boyfriend ghosted you like 17 times a day.
Yeah. I don't know. You'd have to just have a little separate timer, like 7 minutes to know, okay, they got it. And then you wouldn't get the verification that they got it, right?
For another 7 minutes. So it's like 14 minutes. You can't even interrupt someone.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's just Mars. That's just like the closest planet, you know, we can imagine. Well, yeah. Landing stuff on that survives for more than 5 minutes.
What is more likely, based on your research and your writing and you drinking with your friends and jackassing around and talking about this stuff and pouring it into chapters and books, nanobots getting together and replicating themselves and destroying the planet in a matter of minutes, or human beings colonizing another part of space, which could but does not necessarily have to include Mars?
I'd give that a 50-50, actually. As difficult as it would be to land a human on Mars, we will probably still attempt it and eventually succeed.
And then what?
And then we're back at square one.
Then we send Matt Damon. Remember when he died at the end of The Martian?
Yeah, it's sad.
So sad.
He wouldn't be the first person.
Would you choose someone you really like and respect, or someone you hate, hoping you never see them again?
Definitely the latter.
Smart. That's why you wrote the book, because nanobots... you acknowledge a darkness in existence, and maybe the darkness is just intellectual agnosticism, which is fine. But sorry, go ahead with the nanobots, because this was one part of the book, because I'm not scared by AI or sex robots. I think everything has its place, and in a lot of ways, we're already there. But the nanobots, that whole scenario, and please describe what that is for people listening, because that is terrifying.
Yeah, it was a kind of one of these futurists, the people that think about the far future and try to extrapolate trends way into the future, came up with this idea of, called it gray goo, but it's not gooey and it's not gray. He just kind of used that term to make it sound mundane. So the idea is we're building nanotechnology, and we think we can do things like create tiny little robots, and they can go inside you, and you know, maybe they can target cancer cells and kill them, stuff like that. And our technology just keeps getting better and better, and to the point where, yeah, we could probably build, you know, nanoscale robots. And if you say misprogrammed one to say build a copy of itself, what would it do? Well, if it was nanoscale, it'd be like the size of atoms. So we'd just be looking around and not even know whether it's inside of a body or on the ground. And it would just see atoms and say, okay, I can use those to build a copy of myself. And then it builds a copy. And then that copy says, well, my programming is only to build a copy of myself. So they both build another copy, and now you have four. And then those four build a copy, and now you have eight, right? And then you have 16. So if they can do this...
Well, that's geometric. You said it would be exponential copying.
Yeah, well, it doubles every time it takes to make a copy, they double, right? So if you say after they copy once a second, and after 10 seconds, how many are there? It's 2 to the power of 10. I can't do the math in my head, but whatever that is. But the point is 2 to some power that's like, let's say 300 seconds. Or 500 seconds doesn't seem like a big number, but if you actually put that in your calculator, it's an enormous number, right? So if they could do it once a second, you know, in a matter of hours, the whole planet, all the atoms in the whole planet would have been used up to create copies of this tiny little robot, and we wouldn't, there'd be nothing we can do about it. So it has something to do with the bigger problem has something to do with failures in complex systems. So when you have a complex system, all the parts of the system share the same fate. So if you think about, the last time Facebook went down or Google went down, it was just someone entered the wrong number in some code to upgrade some server. And that didn't work. But then the whole system went down. And there's no way you can predict it, and basically no way you can create fail safes for it, because it's a huge complex system and you don't know how all the parts work together. And so when we introduce some fundamental fault in this complex system of like life on Earth, we won't be able to predict what will happen. So,
no, I mean, it's like Y2K. Yeah. Everyone thought the world was going to end.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I wouldn't try to compare us to doomsayers and
they're like, that's it. There's no two. There's no two. It's all 19s. There's no 20. Yeah. We're hosed. That's it. Like, everything's going to seize up. All the nuclear codes are set to 19. And the second it goes to January 1st at midnight, we're hosed. We're done. I hope it was fun. Hope it was worth it. A-holes.
Well, that's a different sort of thing, right? Because we're just telling people what science tells us about the world around us and how that might play out in the future. Making a very specific claim is super dangerous, because you could be wrong, but more so than that, if you're saying something bad's going to happen, then people will do things to prevent that from happening, and then it won't happen. So you'll be wrong, but you kind of achieve your goal of warning people about it. It's called the self-defeating prophecy.
Mm, right? Sounds so like it's Cassandra. It's hard. She's my favorite in all of mythology.
Yeah, so it's difficult to be that person that has to like warn people about about threats, like real threats, not us. We're not warning people about real threats because there's nothing you can do about an asteroid that's going to come tomorrow or anything like that. But you know, specific threats like Y2K, you know, if you're the one, you know, warning people about it, well, then people are going to do something about it. And then it won't happen. And you're going to be told that you're wrong.
But what if everyone does like something like they're expected to with global climate change? What if we all, you know, it's like you present a very mixed bag in terms of nuclear energy, which I tend to err on the side of it's abundant and it's cheap and it doesn't emit greenhouse gases. But you're kind of like, yeah, but the radioactive waste is almost impossible to dispose of. But then you also were very honest about it and said if you smoke 30 cigarettes a day, you are interfacing with far more radioactive material than a nuclear disaster. But if we all do the right thing, if we all get electric vehicles and we have power grids that are fueled by thorium nuclear reactors and everything is cleaner, but what if nothing changes? What if we really weren't the influencer in the first place and Earth was just going to change and the climate was just going to change, and even if we clean everything up and we have this forced austerity and it doesn't do any good, then what?
Well, I think that there's a big complicated problem there, right? So the first thing is, you know, if we have scientists, lots of scientists, the vast majority of scientists warning us that climate change is, is happening. That can be verified by just putting a thermometer outside one year and then the next year and seeing that it's hotter on average, but that also we're causing it, and that makes us feel bad, right? Because they say, look, something bad's happening, and also it's your fault. Of course, people aren't going to react positively to that.
I don't think that is the best way to get people to change their behavior. I actually don't think that works, because all people do is they look at the doomsdayers who are like, by 2006, the polar ice caps will melt and New York City will be underwater. So you're not going to get to go to MoMA. And I hope that was fun that you lived your inartful life and now you're dead, or you're going to be dead really soon. And then, you know, 2007 rolls around. It's like Y2K. It's like, well, we're still here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're putting some efforts. Yeah. We're putting some efforts into mitigating it, right? But we have all of these predicted things that are going to go wrong. And if we do something about it, you know, say we stop, you know, 2.5% global temperature rises by 2050 or whatever, then all of the things that we thought were going to happen from the modeling won't happen. And then people will say, oh, you scientists were all wrong, right? So that's the self-defeating prophecy. But, I would frame it differently if I was in charge of what scientists say to the public about it.
What
I wouldn't
would you
frame
say?
It as, I would say, you know, look, in the future, a warmer planet is going to be a problem. So, you can help solve that problem today, right? Would you like to help and be the hero of our existential crisis? And it doesn't have to be about you caused the problem or I'm blaming you. It's just there is a problem. There is a problem, and you know, you can support people that want to help solve it, or you can help yourself.
See, here's what I would say. I would say, do you want to have nice things? Because everyone goes, yeah, we want to have nice things. Like when you go hiking, do you want there to be dirt and rocks and trees and birds and animals and the circle of life? Yes, absolutely. I want that. Okay, well then when you go back to your house, do you want to leave the heat on and the windows open and the lights on all night long just because you can? And people go, yeah, that sounds amazing. That's what I've always wanted. And you go, well, we can't do that. If we continue with fossil fuels, you are killing both dreams. But if we switch to some renewable energy, but most nuclear energy, you can have all of that. Then, you know, people are motivated by aspirational images. And they're like, yes, that's what I want. I want to be a glutton. I want to be a clean earth glutton. I want to be able to see my toes when I walk in a stream. I want beautiful, pristine beaches that I can go and surf any time of the year, which is much more likely if the planet is a little warmer. I mean, it's like Endless Winter was a movie that didn't do very well. Endless Summer is iconic.
It's Australia, I can confirm.
We have more of this interview in moments coming up. Australia is amazing. It is the most incredible country on the planet for a number of reasons. Everyone likes to party and have a good time. You guys minimize everything and give everything super cute nicknames, even things that can kill you. And the most dangerous of any type of thing that might scare you lives in Australia. And people are still really happy, and there are super cool places to go. And also, they're figuring out how to save the Great Barrier Reef. Like, people are using education and innovation, which also requires a free market, to figure out how to save the most beautiful things we have.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to argue with that.
So it's like, Australians have already been given, you know, it's like, do you want a clean planet, and do you want gluttony? And Australians were the first ones to go, yeah, we do, pick us. That sounds great. Boom, Australia.
Yeah, I think in the end, we also as humans, we're generally a little bit lazy. You know, we do our own thing and we work hard at our own thing, but there's lots of things to worry about in the world. And so for all those other things, we think, well, I don't want to work as hard as I did on my thing to solve that thing as well. So I just want a simple answer. Just give me the simple answer, right? And the problem, yeah, the issue is there isn't simple answers. There isn't a simple answer to you know, solve climate change or decide whether we should switch to nuclear or, you know, whether we should all drive electric cars. I mean, those aren't free to produce, right? So
no, and they also, like, they also are not without consequence.
It moves, you know, it moves, yeah, it might move pollution out of a city, but at the expense of putting it somewhere else, right? So there isn't just a simple answer to these things. And I think, like, for me, you know, I have my area of expertise, and when people have quantum physics problems, they come to me, not like those are ever really, you know, big problems, but they can come to me if they have a problem that they need to solve. And that's how I approach my life. And I think generally how most people approach their life, if they have a health problem, they go to a health expert. If they have a financial problem, they go to a financial expert. But somehow when we have like these big social, like community, societal problems, we don't trust the experts, which is weird. That's what we should do, right? So I don't have the answers. You know, I just switching over isn't something that we can do, right? You can't just say, oh, well, we'll just switch over to nuclear plants. No, you can't just do that. There's a lot of infrastructure that's set up for the way we do it now, right? And
people have don't have a hard time shutting them down.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Looking at you, Germany.
Shuts them down pretty quickly.
No, I get it, but there's, I think there are, we demonize things unnecessarily. And we demonize each other unnecessarily. And I think it is to our own detriment. I want to ask you before we part about the mutant ape and having 46 chromosomes instead of 48, because I had never heard that. And I think it's fascinating. How did that happen? And how did that anomaly survive?
Well, I mean, sometimes things that we see in the world. So we look at organisms like humans or plants, and we say, oh wow, that's so well adapted to its environment, you know, it must have been designed that way. But then you look at like other parts of it and you're like, what, well, you know, what is that for, right? Like, why do we have hair, right, in this environment? It doesn't seem to be, you know, very ideally adapted.
That's what I asked my evolutionary biology teacher, and everyone laughed at me when I raised my hand when I was at UCLA and I said, why do men have nipples? And everyone laughed. And then the ones who weren't laughing were hissing at me as though I were wasting the professor's time. But his answer was fascinating because men were not necessarily designed to lactate and offer milk to their offspring. But the female form is the default one, and it doesn't change and turn into a male until testosterone is introduced.
Right. So, you know, you can kind of make evolutionary arguments to say, like, well, it would have been very difficult to, like, create a genetic code that is going to differentiate the two sexes in a sexually reproducing species. So much, right? But in some species, they are extremely differentiated, right? Black widow spiders, whatever it is, 10 times the size of females, 10 times the size of the male, right? So sometimes you do see these things, and it could be for evolution. Like,
that's
really
like
clear,
male seahorses have the babies and then stay home with them all day, while the female seahorses like party and go to Caribbean resorts with their girlfriends, I think. But there was a mutant ape, like a chimpanzee. That's our closest primate relative, correct?
Well, we have, so there, we and the other great apes we're like cousins, right? So we didn't evolve from apes, and I hope no one thinks apes evolved from us. There was we had great, 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 lots of greats, grandparent. And then all the other, parts of the like Homo family, like Homo erectus and these other sort of
Australopithecus afarensis.
Yeah. All those things, we all kind of branched out from a common ancestor, like, you know, millions of years ago. And so we and the chimpanzees diverged in the evolutionary tree. So yeah, we're like distant cousins, not really related, but you know, we share the same
Habsburg
a lot of the same DNA as every other living thing, right? I mean, anything that reproduces with DNA shares so more commonality than what we observe as differences, right? So you and a cucumber, whatever, are from just like counting information contained in DNA, right? Are as close for all practical purposes as you and an ape. Yeah. So, but the changes that occur when things evolve sometimes are for good reason, right? So a change occurs in the DNA and your offspring have some different trait than you, and that confers an advantage in the environment that they're in, and then they survive longer, reproduce more, and then that continues on. But that trait might come along with something else that's like irrelevant, like eye color, for example, right? We all seem to have like randomly colored eyes that confer no real obvious advantage. So that kind of just came along for the ride. And so you see probably the vast majority of things when you like really dig down and look at it, you're like, okay, well, that doesn't seem to confer like a huge advantage in any environment that your ancestors might have been in. It's largely a random process, right? It doesn't, something that is well adapted to an environment doesn't guarantee that it's going to survive. And something that just has an irrelevant trait that comes along with a good trait, it doesn't mean that they're not going to survive.
But our survival, considering what we're up against, which is laid out in 42 chapters of 42 reasons to hate the universe optimistically, and one reason not to, you should get it now because there is so much in here that is so interesting and funny that makes you think and is presented in a way that I guarantee you, you've never encountered in any other science book. And I think it's fantastic. I appreciate getting to talk to you again, Chris Ferry. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know that you are in Australia and you've got several animals in your house. I hope you do not have a saltwater crocodile.
No, not yet.
The day is young there. All right. thank you so much. Go read the book. And that's all she wrote. This has been Kennedy Saves the World. I'm Kennedy.
For more podcasts from my friends at Fox, you can go to foxnewspodcast.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. Oh, go ahead and leave me a review while you're there. I'd love to hear what you have to say. You've been listening to Kennedy Saves the World on the Fox News Podcast Network.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.